The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
When he created the character of Ross O'Carroll Kelly, it was something of a little joke that was meant to last 10 weeks. 23 years on, and the 21st novel called Normal Sheeple is going to be published this week. And if you're feeling a little bit guilty about your productivity during the pandemic, this is just one of four books that Paul Howard is involved in this year. And as you can hear, he's laughing already. He's with me in studio. Paul, it's a momentous week for you. First of all, you're very welcome because you've both a book and a ball gladder due out this week.
Well, actually, I was laughing because you're making me feel really old.
Which but
I feel
it does.
I feel old anyway. But yeah, I'm getting my gallbladder removed on Tuesday. I was supposed to get it done last Monday. I was in the hospital. I was kind of putting the gown on, and I was told that the surgeon had been called out to do a transplant. And so I was sent home again.
Fair enough.
I didn't say a word. I put my clothes back on and walked out of the hospital and just waited for a phone call.
Look, I know we're having a little bit of a laugh, but like, I mean, you had a serious kind of health scare earlier this year. You actually thought you were having a heart attack.
Yeah, I did. I tend to let stuff go. I'm a shocker, like when it comes to my health. Like if something is bothering me, I just will leave it, you know. And but I had these chest pains. And I get really, really bad acid indigestion and reflux anyway. I've had like a whole lifetime of stomach problems. So I kind of ignored it. I just thought it was that. I just thought that was kind of more of the same. But I had this chest pain that went on for about, I think it was about 36 hours.
You let it go on for 36 hours?
Yeah, I did. But I had been reading about this phenomenon known as Sniper Alley in this magazine.
Men in their 50s?
Yeah, men in their 50s. Things up on various rooftops, health things on rooftops, pointing, you know, rifles at you. And so that kind of frightened me a bit. And then when this chest pain didn't go after 36 hours, I said, right, this is serious. Mary, my wife, knew it was serious because the Champions League final was on, and I left that 20 minutes in to go to the hospital and just presented myself in A&E and said, I have these chest pains. And, you know, they thankfully, like the triage nurse checked me over and established pretty quickly that it wasn't a heart attack. Like, you know, I'm a bit of a catastrophist, despite not kind of looking after my health too well. When I'm told something is wrong, I immediately go, this is it. This is nuclear. And they established I wasn't having a heart attack. And then they admitted me and discovered I had this, like, it's the size of a golf ball, a gallstone.
But that will chime with a lot of, particularly men who, you know, kind of are maybe aware something's wrong, but they take so much time to go and get things checked out.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I mean, I would sit down with my friends and just say, God, you know what? I'm getting really, really bad chest pains lately. You know, I talk about it, but wouldn't dream of going and bothering a doctor with it, you know. And I think that has a lot to do with, like, my upbringing. Like, you know, we were never, like, there was no man flu in our house. Like, you know, we were, like, I remember one time, you know, I had, it turned out I had glandular fever. I just thought I had a cold, you know, my eardrum burst and I couldn't hear. And I still went out to work. And I was taken to hospital because I noticed my, you know, my whole body had come out in these purple rashes. And it turned out I had septicemia. The infection had gone to my bloodstream. So by the time I got to hospital, they said, yeah, you had about 24 hours left, you know. So I'm right up against the deadline naturally when it comes to these things. You know, I leave it till the very last minute.
I hate to say it, it's a bit of an Irish thing, but you look incredibly well on it.
I know. I've lost a load of weight, right? So the whole summer I've been on this diet. It's a no-fat diet, which means no, I can't eat steak. All the things I love, steak, cheese, red wine. So I'm eating really healthily. So I'm eating fish, vegetables, you know, seeds. Like, who knew you could eat seeds? Like, the things you put in the bird feeder, you can actually eat them yourself.
You must be great crack at the barbecues, are you?
I arrive at the barbecue. I have done this three or four times this summer with a Ziploc bag and a piece of hake in the Ziploc bag, swing it. And I am the fun guy, you know. But I've lost a lot of weight, but I've lost so much weight that my friends, when they see me, they think twice about complimenting me on it in case there's something wrong.
But But and throughout all of this, you have been absolutely prolific. Did you feel, I know you turned 50 earlier this year, is it sort of a kind of a big symbolic threshold that you the Passover, despite going into, gaining entry into Sniper's Alley?
40 was a bigger thing for me. Like, I really did feel with 40 that I'd kind of, to use a golfing phrase, like entered the back nine. 50 wasn't that big a deal, but I think because we were locked down, because it I mean, it was barely acknowledged, you know, that I turned 50 in our house, you know, like it was, because there's no party to have. Like, I've got about six or seven friends who've all turned 50 in the last 6 months. And we've said, we will know the pandemic is over. Like, our VE day is when we celebrate our 50th birthday together. And we'll do that. But 50, it wasn't, look, to be honest, I've always kind of felt a bit old. I felt like a fogey from the time I was about 26 anyway. So,
what are you looking most forward to after the gallbladder surgery? Is it going to be straight for the wine or?
Oh, Sheridan's. Like, I'm taking a detour past Sheridan's. I'm going to get about, like, you know, 8 pounds of cheese. I don't know if I'll be allowed to eat them straight away. Like, it might be a while before I can return to normal eating again. But I've drawn up I'm like a guy on death row, like writing out my last meal, you know, all these things, steak, cheese,
wine,
deep fried chicken, deep fried fish, wine,
Do you think it's a permanent change? Will you keep it going?
I mean, I know I'll have to, cause without a gallbladder, you can live without a gallbladder, actually.
So, is it kind of like the tonsils or those other parts?
The spleen, all these bits of us that, you know, evolution hasn't got rid of yet. You can live perfectly well without it, but I know I will have to regulate my fat intake because I won't have as much, my body won't be producing as much bile to break down fatty foods. So it's just whatever bile the liver produces. So instead of having chips 3 nights a week, I'll probably be once a week or once every 2 weeks.
Well, from normal eating to normal sheeple.
Lovely segue.
from gallbladders to books, normal sheeple. It is. Now, before we get to the book, how is this your third book of four? Like, I mean, I thought I'd been doing okay during the pandemic in terms of getting a few things done. But what is your work rate like?
Yeah, I suppose I'm quite prolific, you know, and during lockdown, I remember when the lockdown happened, I had these four books on my plate because all four books that came out this year were written last year, and I had these four deadlines. So it was the Rock of Ages, which was the book of Ross O'Carroll Kelly columns, Aldrin Adams and the Cheese Nightmares, which is a children's book, and this book, Normal Sheeple, and then of another Gordon book I wrote with Gordon Darcy coming out in October called Lion's Roar. So all four had to be written last year. And I remember in February last year thinking, I've taken on far too much work. I don't know how I'm going to do this. And when the lockdown happened, awful as it was, there was nothing else to do. I couldn't see my friends. I couldn't see my family. Obviously, we couldn't go out to dinner. We couldn't. It totally stripped away that sort of social part of my life and allowed me to work. I get up at 5 o'clock every morning to work, but this allowed me to work till 7 or 8 o'clock at night.
How many hours do you put in a day?
I mean, too many, really. You know, probably like 12 most days. But the last 2 or 3 hours aren't as productive as the first hours. Like from 5 until 1 o'clock, I do. That's an 8 hour day. I'd get quite a lot done. I slow up a bit in the afternoon. But look, there have been times when I've been at the computer in the evening as well. And it's bad. I'm trying to get to a place where I can, you know, work a little bit less.
Let's come back to Ross, because it is an extraordinary character who has endured for you and for so many of your fans for so long. What is it about him that makes him such an endurable character? Because he's evolved so much in the Checks Notes 23 years we've been with him.
Well, what's interesting, a few people have said this to me, that at the very beginning, the early Ross books, he was the least sympathetic, least relatable character in the books. He was this anti-hero, really. But as the series has gone on, and probably as I've become more sympathetic towards him, and you can't but after, you know, writing about a character for 23 years and 21 books, he's actually become, in a strange way, the most likable character in the books, and actually the only normal character, the only character in the books whose moral compass is true, You know, in normal sheeple, his dad has become the Taoiseach. And it's just this absolute nightmare scenario for Ireland where this man who's essentially like an Irish Times letter writer has become the most powerful man in the country. And his and Surika, Ross's wife, has become the Minister for Climate Action. And her plan is to essentially make sheep and cows extinct in Ireland, just to breed them out of existence. And all this madness is going on around Ross. And he's kind of in the middle, just an observer.
He has become the insanity. He's become the normal person. Sally Rooney actually must be delighted that her you know you've made it when you get a play on on your book being Ross O'Carroll Kelly. Can I talk to you about what the character allows you to do? Because he sort of lets you get away with saying things that you might not say in company, polite or otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of kind of wish fulfillment, I suppose, going on with Ross. People ask me a lot, are you like Ross in any way? I'm not, absolutely not. But being able to say the thing that you want to say, you know, it's like that Larry David thing. You get yourself in these social situations and afterwards you think, do you know what I should have said? Well, Larry David always says the thing that you wish you'd said and Ross always says the thing you wish you'd said. So that little bit of me that's a moral coward who kind of walks away from those situations, Ross just speaks his mind.
The backstory, and I know we've heard it before, but of how the Ross O'Carroll Kelly character came about, does it still, just remind us of it, and does it still kind of amaze you that you've made a career out of something you spotted in your journalism career that you just thought, that's mad?
Yeah, it is really strange for me still that the people I'm sending up are essentially my audience. You know, like I remember getting the solicitor's letter, I've spoken about it before, from the father of a kid whose name I got wrong. Actually, I was covering a school's rugby match and I gave the try to the wrong kid. That's what happened. And I was stringing for the Independent at the time and I got called in by the sports editor and he said, you know, we've got the solicitor's letter. They're looking for a correction, a retraction and an apology. And I was thinking, God, I said, that sounds a bit heavy. Like I was like 18 at the time and it was my first solicitor's letter at 18. And so I said, is that a bit heavy? And he said, well, what do you know about schools rugby? And I said, well, nothing. Like, you know, I barely know the laws of rugby. And he explained it to me. He said, this kid, he's born and his father puts a rugby ball in the bassinet in Mount Cormel Hospital, right? Just to familiarise him with the shape of the ball. And he said, the dad is telling everybody in the golf club, you know, my son is going to play for Ireland one day. He's going to play senior rugby for the school as well. And the kid, like as soon as the kid can walk, he's got a ball in his hand. That ball never leaves his hand. He goes and he plays as a toddler. He plays junior cup. And finally, he makes it onto the senior cup team. And in his first match, he scores this wonder try. As the guy said to me, and you got his name wrong. I kind of understood it then, you know.
It's, you know, it's extraordinary. I often wonder, you know, are people terrified in your company, you know, when you're out for dinner or whatever? Are they terrified you're going to do a Nora Ephron, everything is copy style thing on them? Like, are you mentally taking kind of notes on things that people say?
My friends are used to me. It's sort of strangers sitting at nearby tables in Avoca ham weavers who generally move away from me, which I have had that experience like of, you know, three women at a table picked up their trays and walked away when they saw me sitting down beside them. And they said, one of them said to me, you are not making a monkey out of us. But generally, I think the people I send up find it quite funny. You know, it is unusual. It's just such a strange twist for me. That like when I started writing Ross, I had so many chips on my shoulder about class, which I had growing up, like, you know, because I was, you know, grew up in a working class home and, you know.
Were you taking them out? Were you exercising it through the books?
I mean, I did it when I was a teenager, like, you know, I was reading Das Kapital and like listening to the House Martins and kind of writing like sonnets. Can you believe that? I was writing about class through the working class medium of the sonnet. And I look back on that stuff now and I realise I was very angry about class, you know. And when I look back on those early Ross books, I can hear it, you know. I can hear the anger. But the strange thing now is I get invited to rugby clubs and golf clubs and the schools I'm sending. I'm in Blackrock College four times a year, like reading to the kids. And it's strange. And I've kind of become there, you know, in ancient times when the king said, bring me my fool, right? I'm South Dublin's fool now. Like they ring the bell and I come in and I do my stand up. And it's a strange thing. But you know, it's a nice thing as well, you know, that I kind of take it as a compliment that I'm kind of on the nose with the comedy, that they recognise themselves in it and can still laugh.
And what do you think it is? You know, because obviously what we're talking is primarily it was kind of the South Dublin community that you sent up and satirised, and yet you have a huge, huge fan base amongst that. So what is the secret to that?
I think they just see themselves in it, you know, or see some version of themselves. A friend of mine worked in... it was Hughes and Hughes bookshop in the Stephen's Green Shopping Centre. And when the first books came out 20 years ago, he said he would see these kids would come in on a Saturday. And he said, like, there'd be like four of them surround, like sitting around one book, and they'd be reading it together. And he said they all had like the what I call the rugby regimentals, the sailing jacket that's never seen any seawater in its life, the sailing shoes likewise, and the chinos, you know. He said, I just hear, oh, that's so like Tiernan. And they couldn't see themselves. They just saw Tiernan. And so I think they just kind of recognise people like them.
It's so funny. There's lots of questions coming in for you. One of them actually was a guy called Martin. He says he's a lucky escape. He had chest pains for weeks, thought it was a chest infection or indigestion, and he finally went to the doctor and got sent to hospital straight away. A question from Paul from a listener is, are you still angry about class? And if not, why not?
I'm angry. Yeah, I get angry sometimes about things like, for instance, the Beacon Hospital vaccination thing. That made me really angry, like furious. I don't think I have that kind of permanent anger that I had as a teenager, because the Celtic Tiger has, you know, processed me and lots of my friends, lots of people in my generation has essentially processed us into being middle class. Yeah. You know, I own my own
home.
Sorry,
if you look at house prices. Yeah. We're back in that zone again. One of the things I think as well I just want to ask you about was, you know, how your books travel, you know, and like, I mean, the fact that you have, you know, someone as powerful as Samantha Power following you, and then you can go and send this up. As I think I listened to one of the podcasts earlier this week, Samantha Power, the musical.
Yeah.
Near careered off the road. But but what is it about that, even just that?
Well, can I just say, I don't know how Samantha Power feels about Samantha Power the musical yet. She may unfollow me on Twitter. But
she's a great sports fan, which is one of the reasons why she may.
Ah, okay.
A big, big sports fan.
That would make sense, because I tweet mostly about sport. And Samantha, it was so strange because I was writing a song from Samantha Power the musical, which is, it's in Normal Sheeple. It's this school musical that the
in
girls
Mount
from
Anvil.
Mount Anvil put on, because she went to the junior school, and so Mount Anvil are trying to claim her by, you know, creating this musical. And while I was writing the lyrics, I went onto Twitter and Samantha Power followed me. So it was really eerie, like, in that moment. And but they don't really travel, to be honest. I think Samantha would get it because obviously she's had exposure to Ireland.
When
she
Ross
was born
didn't
here,
do
grew
too
up
well
here.
In Russia, did he? He wasn't a rugby player,
no,
at least.
No, the book was, it was the Orange Mocha Chip Frappuccino years, was translated into Russian. And, you know, I used to have these kind of regular conversations with this Russian translator called Alexander Golev. And, you know, so I'd be explaining to him the cultural significance of Avoca Handweavers and, you know, all this cast of characters like Grainne Shoaga and Glenda Gilson. And I would have to explain who they were. And he got all of that. He got his head around all of that. The one thing he couldn't get his head around was that somebody who played rugby could be a hero among their peer group. So in the Russian translation, they made it basketball. So Rosky is a basketball player, which is very strange.
It is very, very strange indeed. One question I wanted to check with you is just how much satire and comedy and the kind of writing you do has changed over the last two decades or more. Because, you know, things have kind of changed, and a lot of comedians, a lot of writers saying, you know, we no longer have that kind of freedom. Have you ever felt any pushback? And particularly during the pandemic, when a lot of the material, a lot of the things we were going through was quite dark and very challenging.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult for all comedians. I've a friend who's a stand-up comedian, and he said that if he sees somebody at one of his gigs filming him with a phone, there's about 7 or 8 jokes he won't tell.
Okay.
The idea that what you're saying is going to become a thing on social media totally changes the energy of a gig. And it's exactly the same for writing. I try not to self-censor as much as I can, but I do understand that, you know, jokes are really like jokes are like fashion. They're like clothes. They're like music. The things that you enjoyed 20 years ago might not be the things that will be enjoyable today. Like, for instance, I watch old episodes of Friends, and Friends is, for me, you know, pretty anodyne as it goes, like as a comedy. Like, there's nothing too particularly challenging about it. But I, you know, there's so many lines you hear in Friends where you just say, I find myself saying out loud, you couldn't say that today. You couldn't say that today. You couldn't say that today. And because Ross, I mean, you know, my books are satirical, and, you know, I push things right to the line. That awareness is always there. But at the same time, you never really know what somebody's going to take offense at. I did a play a few years. It was a Ross one-man show called Postcards from the Ledge. And there's a gag where Ross is essentially selling this house. And it's essentially what you were talking about a few minutes ago before I came on, which is rising property prices. And he's selling this house in Sallynoggin/Glenageary. And it's like, you know, like 1.2 million or something. And it's a kind of rundown house. And you know, so this thing went on Twitter. Should we really be joking about house prices in the time of a housing crisis? And of course you think, well, no, we shouldn't. But at the same time, it's comedy, you know, and comedy has always made certain people uncomfortable. And, you know, and comedy at a certain level is offensive to everybody. And it's just so it's always a challenge.
Yeah, it's a fine line sometimes. There's 10 things you've learned from writing about Ross O'Carroll Kelly. We won't get to all of them, but one, I think, is very interesting. Hardly anyone is called Ross anymore.
I destroyed the name. I have destroyed the name. Like, the reason Ross is called Ross is that at a certain time in the 1990s, practically every second person in my social circle was called Ross, you know, and it was a running joke with us in the pub that someone would come in and say, oh, have you met my brother, Ross? Everybody was called Ross. And do you have the figures there?
Yeah, I do. So in 1998, the year Ross first appeared, it was the 39th most popular name for boys born in Ireland. These are stats from the Central Statistics Office. There was 171 babies called Ross in 1998. And in 2019, there were just 19.
Yeah. It's kind of like being called Donald or something. You know.
You also note in The Real Ireland, Charles O'Carroll Kelly, now Taoiseach, wouldn't have, would probably never have gone to jail. And
never.
Then just, look, I mean, obviously we know Ross through the columns, through the books. Are your readers kind of good continuity analysts? Do they spot if there isn't a good synergy between the columns and the books?
I've given up on trying to maintain some kind of narrative parallel between the two. They've gone off in different directions. And for instance, in the column, Charles, I don't think he's even a TD anymore. I don't think he ran in the last election, whereas in the books, he's the Taoiseach. For a long time in the column, Ross only had 2 kids, and in the books he had
triplets.
5 because he had the triplets. I hadn't introduced the triplets into the column, so I tried to slip them in one weekend, and of course I got hundreds of people saying, "What? Where have these triplets suddenly come from?"
It's bizarre, Paul. We've grown up with Ross. It's so many have grown up with Ross, and I hope that he will be with us for a long, long time to come. It's normal, sheeple, and along with your gallbladder, it is due out this week. And we wish you all the best for your health and everything.
Terrible.
Paul Howard, let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.